Hey guys, my name is Brad. I'm the lead pastor here at New Life Church, and I want to welcome you to our online teachings. One of our core convictions as a church is that everyone is welcome, no one is perfect, and anything is possible. Now, I know that for some of us, coming into a church building might be intimidating, it might be scary, and I get that. But I want you to know that there is always a place for you here at New Life, and that you were made for real in-person community. We meet on Sundays in downtown Wayland. You can check out our website for more information on service times. But for now, I hope God speaks powerfully to you through His Word. Love you guys.
Hey everybody, thank you so much for joining us today. Wherever you're watching from, whenever you're watching this, I hope you know I miss you, and I cannot wait for the day that we can gather again and give each other great big hugs. If you're a guest who is joining us, my name is Brad, and I'm so glad you're here. I also cannot wait to meet you, and I hope you know that this is a place for you, and you can make yourself home as we dive into God's Word together. Now, if you haven't been with us for the last several months, we've been on a journey through the Gospel of Mark. Our simple goal for the beginning of this year has been just to journey with Jesus, and as a result, become people who are more like Him. Now, we are nearing the end of the book of Mark. We only have about 4 chapters left, and things are starting to get a little bit more tense in Jesus' ministry. There's multiple cases where His authority is being challenged, where He's being questioned by the religious leaders. If you were with us last week, David talked about the parable of the tenants and how Jesus spoke to these religious leaders and basically said, "You are stewards, you are not owners of God's promise, and your job is to be a conduit of blessing to the world." And the story we're going to look at today is what happens immediately after that parable. I mean, this parable ruffles the Pharisee and the religious leaders' feathers just a little bit, and this is exactly what they do next. Mark chapter 12, verse 13, we're going to dive right into the text today. "And they sent to him some of the Pharisees and some of the Herodians to trap him in his talk," right? So they're a little bit ruffled by Jesus right now. "And they came and said to him, 'Teacher, we know that you are true and do not care about anyone's opinion, for you are not swayed by appearances, but truly teach the way of God.'" Now, if you have any sense of self-awareness, you know that they are just flattering Jesus right now. This is total empty flattery because they are setting him up for a trap. Watch what happens next here. They ask, "Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Should we pay them or should we not?" But knowing their hypocrisy, this is the genius of Jesus, he said to them, "Why put me to the test?" He's like, "Come on, guys, what are you doing? Bring me a denarius and let me look at it." And they brought one. And he said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is on this?" They said to him, "Caesar's." Jesus said to them, "Then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's." And they marveled at him. Now, this is arguably one of the most explicitly political conversations that Jesus has in his entire ministry. And oftentimes, I think when we read this story from a surface level, just kind of reading it from our American Western mindset, we immediately just assume, okay, Jesus is telling us to pay our taxes and to worship him. Done. That's it. That's the end of the story. The problem is, Jesus is getting at something way deeper, as he always does. What's so brilliant about him is he takes a political trap and he turns it into a teachable theological lesson that I believe we can learn something from for our current cultural moment, our current political climate. Now, before we dive in, I just want to let you know where I'm coming from with this teaching, because I think it's really easy whenever we begin to talk about the topic of politics to make some really kind of bold assumptions. Right? Like, what is his agenda? What angle is he coming from? What is he trying to kind of push on me? And so I thought, as a pastor, I see a lot of division, not just within our nation, but within our church around politics. We have people all the way around the political spectrum, from far right to far left, to I don't care, leave me alone. We have people that are really vocal. We have people that are really not vocal. And so here's what my heart is for us today. It's really simple, and I just want to lay it out plainly before we really dive into the content. My heart for us today is that we have a political climate, a political culture that tends to make us less like Jesus. As a pastor, as a disciple of Jesus, as a member of this community, my heart and my goal is that we become more like Jesus. And when we do that, when we walk through that process, there is always a little bit of churn. There is always a little bit of discomfort that we have to navigate through. There is always a little bit of exposing of our idols, of things that need to be flipped over in our lives so that we can become more like him. And so as we go through this process, as we begin to talk about politics a little bit today, I want to begin by asking you a question. This is a really simple question, but have you ever had competing allegiances with a family member or a friend? Have you ever had a little friendly competition around your competing allegiances? I know you have. I have too. Maybe half of your family is a major U of M fan, and half of your family is a major MSU fan. And then you have those weird relatives you don't talk to who live in Ohio, and they like Ohio State. And you all pretty well get along for the most part until your favorite teams play each other, and then it is an all-out war. Maybe you have a house divided over Chipotle versus Qdoba or McDonald's or Burger King or Coke versus Pepsi. Our entire world is all about competing allegiances and who are you loyal to and who are you faithful to and what box are you going to fit in. Think about this in the marketing world. What brands are you most allegiant to? Where is your allegiance for brands and for marketing or for celebrities and bands or for politicians and parties and politics? I mean, we live in a world that demands our allegiance. And the single question that I want us to work through today, the single question that this entire teaching that Jesus is speaking to right here, it's one simple question. And it's this: who has my allegiance? Who has my allegiance? They ask the question in the form of, is it right to pay taxes to Caesar? Who has your allegiance, Jesus? Which party do you endorse, Jesus? Where is your political affiliation, Jesus? I mean, they want to put him in a cultural box for his time. And to be honest, he really doesn't have anything of it. He gives them a different answer, one that they would not have expected. And the text ends by saying, and they marveled at him. And so I want to dive into this because there's some really fascinating stuff about this text that you're not going to get just from reading it at surface level. Because Mark here, he's not just talking about whether or not Christians or followers of Jesus should pay taxes. This isn't a general tax question. This is about a very specific tax of oppression levied on the Jewish people. You see, the Jewish people had to pay all sorts of different taxes, but this specific one that Mark is talking about is a type of poll tax, if you will. It was not levied on Roman citizens, but it was basically a way for non-Roman citizens to pledge their ultimate allegiance to Caesar. And so this coin had Caesar's image on it. It had his inscription on it. And there's a lot of tension in this question. Because if Jesus answers, well, yeah, pay your taxes to Caesar, you ought to, well, that's cause for a Jewish revolt. And if Jesus says, no, don't pay this tax to Caesar, that's cause for arrest and crucifixion that day. And so this is a really tough kind of question that they put before Jesus. I mean, this is a Facebook fight waiting to happen. I was thinking about how could we put it in terms that we would understand? Because sometimes I don't think it's easy for us to understand the level of offensiveness of some of these things that the Jewish people had to endure. And the closest thing that I could think of is imagine that we had a coin in circulation. And on one side of the coin was a picture of Governor Whitmer, and on the other side was a picture of President Trump. And the side with Governor Whitmer said, in Whitmer we trust, and the side with President Trump said, in Trump we trust. Now that I've offended absolutely everybody watching this, can you get a picture of how offensive this coin would have been for the Jewish people? Because not only Not only did it have Caesar's picture on it, which would have violated Jewish law, no graven images. This was a direct violation of Jewish law. It was idolatry. But what's worse is the words that it said on it about Caesar. You see, on one side, this denarius coin, it said, Caesar, son of the divine. Caesar was often referred to as a son of the gods. And on the other side, it had the words, high priest. Man, this collides with the Jewish faith. And these two groups of people, these Pharisees and these Herodians, were absolute political enemies. It would be like the Tea Party and Democratic Socialists coming together because they have a common enemy in Jesus. The Pharisees resisted this coin. It was a violation of the religious law. The Herodians were a group of people who hungered after political power, and so they gave up a lot of their convictions, their religious morals, for the sake of getting in bed with Caesar and colluding with him and kind of colluding with the Roman Empire. So these two people are not friendly. And then you have a third group called the Zealots, who downright revolted against the Roman Empire because of this coin. There are multiple well-documented historical revolts by the Zealots, a Jewish resistance party, specifically because of the coin in reference here. Can you imagine the catch-22 that Jesus is in? These are some of the final days of his life. The crowds are pressing in on him. This question is posed, and in this moment of political tension, upheaval, everyone wants to know what Jesus has to say. And then he speaks, and I want to reread his words to you once again in verse 15. It says, but knowing their hypocrisy, Jesus said to them, why are you guys putting me to the test? Come on, guys. Bring me a denarius and let me look at it. And so even the fact that he was brought one and he held one, I mean, that's offensive to begin with to people like the Zealots. And so he's holding it here. It's already offensive. And then he asks, whose likeness and inscription is this? They said to him, Caesar's. And Jesus said to them, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. And they marveled at him. This is what's so brilliant about Jesus. It's almost as if he takes this coin that caused so much division, so many problems, and he simply just shrugs his shoulders, treats it as almost non-consequential, and says, just toss it back to Caesar. Stop fighting over this. You are giving this single coin so much more power in your lives than it deserves. This is blasphemous. It's an idolatrous coin. Just give it back to Caesar. Don't put so much weight in it. You're not pledging ultimate allegiance to Caesar by paying this tax. You're just give it back and get some more important stuff. That's why he follows it up with, like, if this coin is what belongs to Caesar, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, but then give to God the things that are God's. Which begs the question, if the coin belongs to Caesar because it bears his image, who belongs to God because they bear his image? Well, humanity, you, me. Caesar gets his coin. Caesar gets his tax. But what does God get? God gets us. God gets all of us. Jesus is pretty clear here that God gets our exclusive allegiance. Give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, but when you give to God, you are giving all of you to God. He is your allegiance, not just one among many allegiances. He is your ultimate allegiance. And so what's brilliant is he speaks to each political party essentially there, and he says, Zealots, like if money is not your ultimate God, your ultimate allegiance, just toss it back and quit making such a big deal about it. Live peacefully and honorably, even towards your oppressor. It's offensive. To the Herodians, if power and political authority and political control is your ultimate allegiance, you are also missing the point. Give to Caesar what Caesar's. Don't give him more power than he needs in your life. And to the Pharisees, the ones who desired to uphold Jewish law and faithfully live out Torah. He says the same. He says, why don't you focus on embodying Torah to people that pushes them towards God, not away from God? You're having the wrong fight. You guys are mad about something because you're not in the right fight. You wanna live out my kingdom? Care about biblical justice. Care about the vulnerable. Care about cultivating this dignity and this image of God in all people. Instead of the petty political fighting, stop giving it so much power in your lives. This is the message of Jesus to this group of people here in this time. I can't help but imagine that it has some implications for us. In 2020, in the middle of an election year, in the middle of a heated, tense political moment, I can't help but imagine that there are some really important implications that you and me need to take away from this interaction with Jesus. And so was Jesus political? Absolutely. He was very political. He spoke to the political issues of his day. The very act of crucifixion was a political act. But it wasn't partisan. It was political. Jesus was political, but he wasn't partisan. Why? Why does it matter that Jesus was political, but he was not partisan? Because I think Jesus understood something that I sometimes forget, and maybe you do too. I don't know. Jesus understood that you cannot divide your allegiances, that you have one exclusive allegiance to give. And what Jesus does is he doesn't just see outward appearance, he sees the heart, and he sees where ultimate allegiance lies. He's talking to a bunch of groups of people with split allegiances, like, are you in, are you out? Like, where do you... Jesus didn't come just to make a better version of the Roman Empire. Jesus came to usher in a whole new kingdom. And that's what we need to understand about the politics of Jesus, is that it's a really dangerous game to want to fit him into the partisan boxes that we have created, because he just flat out rejects those, not just here, but over and over again throughout the Gospels. And so what I think is some really important principles for us to understand about the way that Jesus spoke about politics, the way that he engaged politics, is that he rejects the way of violent revolt against government. He advocates for this idea of living peaceably and honorably towards even an oppressor. Paul talks about this in Romans 13. He talks about submitting yourselves to the government. Now, submitting yourself to a government is different than ultimate allegiance to a government. Submitting yourself to a government means, because I have ultimate allegiance to the authority of Jesus in my life, where and when possible, I will live at peace with the governing authorities that I am under. Now, there's very clear biblical precedent for civil disobedience when government authority violates the law of God, when it violates biblical justice. So I'm not saying accept everything a government does. That would be ultimate allegiance. What I'm saying is peacefully and honorably submit. If that's offensive to you, think about the people who wrote these words about submitting to governing authorities. I mean, they were at risk of being murdered by their government authorities, and yet they speak these words, submit. Jesus advocates for the idea of disadvantaging yourself for the advantage of other people, not hoarding power, not hoarding money, not living out of scarcity, but actually putting yourself at a disadvantage for the sake of your neighbor. Jesus is an example of standing up for justice, for what is right, for what is true, for standing on convictions that cannot be swayed by the changing tide of the political moment of the day, but standing firm on his word and what he calls us to as people. Jesus, if you're following Jesus, and not just Jesus in your image, but the true Jesus, he will always mess with your competing allegiances. I'm still learning things about who Jesus is, and I'm still becoming more like him. And I think what we tend to do is we think of our politics, our convictions around society and the ordering of society as fixed things, as if we have ultimately arrived and our view is right and we can't possibly learn and grow. Guys, that's not what following Jesus is ever about. It's about constantly reevaluating my life against how he has revealed himself in this book, and as a result, becoming more like him. Can it be said of you that your ultimate allegiance is to Jesus? That your exclusive allegiance is to the one who came to offer you life? Can that be said of you in your work situation? When you're treated unfairly, if your ultimate allegiance is to comfort and to security and to finances, well, yeah, you're gonna lash out. That's a human nature thing to do. But if your ultimate allegiance is to Jesus, that warrants a different response. Political, if your ultimate allegiance is to Jesus, then the politics of our day should not divide the church. They shouldn't. That we ought to, and hear me on this, I have messed up in this area. I'm not perfect in this area. I'm learning and I'm growing. So if I can have permission to grow with you in this area, if our ultimate allegiance is to Jesus and not to politics, well, then we seek peace with our neighbors. We seek peace with those who we may not have perfect, flawless agreement with. You think Paul, when he was writing letters to these churches and these different communities, you think that he was writing to perfectly politically unified churches? You think that he was writing to churches who all had identical political views to each other? We know that's not true. We know there was diversity of opinion in Paul's letters to these different churches. And the same way is with us. I don't expect us to have a flawlessly uniform political view here at New Life Church and in Wayland, but I do expect us, because of our ultimate allegiance to Jesus, to have unity of mission and oneness of heart as we pursue his kingdom in the world. Financial. It doesn't make sense if your ultimate allegiance is to money to be generous in a time of scarcity. And yet so many of you are. You're taking care of your neighbor and your friend, and you're looking for ways to give of yourselves. That shows an ultimate allegiance to Jesus and not to the stuff in your life, not to the material in your life. Social. If your ultimate allegiance is to Jesus, you don't have to insert yourself into every political fight and drop bombs and pour gas on fires that need water poured on them. Is your ultimate allegiance and your exclusive allegiance to Jesus, or are you messing around with competing allegiances? I know this is challenging stuff. This is a high challenge sermon, and I know a lot of us have room to grow, not just how we act online, but in our hearts, and the bitterness and the resentment in our hearts that I think is often welling around this issue of politics. And maybe you're someone that doesn't care. Maybe you're someone that's just like, I'm pretty apathetic about politics. I don't have super, super strong opinions about it. I want to speak to everybody in these next few moments, because I believe the church does have a role, and I believe that this book shows us what the role of the church ought to be in the political realm of things. And so I want to illustrate this in a very specific way with a football, which for those of you that know me, you're equally surprised and impressed that I'm going to use a football illustration, but I think this really shows what I mean by this really well. How many teams are there on a football field? How many teams? Most of us would say two, right? Two teams. The red, we'll just call it the red team and the blue team for argument's sake, okay? But the reality is there's not just two teams on a football field. There's a third team. There's the team that is authoritative on the game. It's the referees. And the role of the referees is to maintain the integrity of the football game, to be the authority in the game, to be the authority on the rules and the way that the teams engage. And so you have the two teams, and all they want to do is win, win, win. And then you have the referees whose job is to call out the fouls, to call out the losses. Now, let me ask you a question. What discredits a referee's authority more than anything else super quickly? It's bias towards a team, right? It's allegiance towards a team. You've seen this in football games where bad calls by referees will ruin a game and hand it over to one team or another. See, friends, I believe, and the New Testament speaks constantly about the role of the church as a prophetic authority in our day. To have convictions, to stand on those convictions, to pursue those convictions. And my fear is that as the church, we have spent so much time obsessing over which team that we play for, which team our allegiance is to, that we were never called to play on either team. We were called to be the prophetic authority in the world, which simply just means that we call out the fouls. Because our ultimate allegiance is to Jesus. We call out injustice when we see it, regardless if it aligns with our political party of choice or not. We call it out. And so my question for you today is, can you see it? From your vantage point where you're standing, can you see when and if your party, your political affiliation of choice is violating this book? Because I'm going to be honest with you, they all do in one way or another. I want to speak to some of the issues that I believe the church is called to speak. At least for me, these are some of the issues that I am most convicted of because of my life circumstance, because of the stuff that I've walked through, that I believe the church has to have a strong voice into. Number one is the issue of ending abortion. I think this is a really important human rights, human dignity issue. I think as a church, we need to have a voice in the end of abortion, not just with the way we vote, because that's one way, and I think we spend a lot of time talking about that way. But what does it look like to be a church that seeks to end the need for abortion in our community by being the place that single moms who are scared and who don't have resources can come and find refuge and help? What does it look like for us to be a church where five different families are willing to adopt unwanted babies at the snap of a finger as an act of scary, risky faith? What does it look like for us to be a church that walks alongside and supports moms? What if we were the place in Wayland and in our surrounding communities that pregnant women who had unwanted pregnancies came to and sought refuge and help? Man, that's a church. That's a church that's a prophetic authority. Another one, generosity. You know, one of our core values as a church is zero needs among us. This idea of radical generosity, sharing our resources with each other, not because of religious obligation, not because you're supposed to tithe or whatever that is, but because you love your neighbor and you love the people around you and you just want to give of yourself for the sake of others. I often, I say this as a joke and I hesitate to say this a little bit, but I really do believe this and I hope you hear my heart here. I believe So I reject the notion of socialism simply because coerced generosity in my understanding of the scriptures is not generosity at all. However, I believe that the resource sharing in the church and the generosity in the church and the way we give of ourselves and pour out ourselves for the sake of those who have needs among us should make socialism look like child's play. That we are such a generous body of people towards each other that we want to give and we want to give and we want to give. And so we reject economic systems that take that from us, not because we want to hoard and because it's our own, but because we want to generously and willingly give of it for the sake of our neighbor. What would it be to be a church that has zero needs among us? That is one of my absolute convictions for our community. What about this one? Compassionate immigration policy. You know, there are Christians that live in other countries south of the border that are struggling, and they are your brothers and sisters in Christ before they are non-U.S. citizens. Friends, America first doesn't work for the kingdom of God. Jesus did not teach seek country first or seek nationality first. Jesus taught seek the kingdom of God first, and all of these things will be added to you. Racial justice, racial reconciliation. Are we adding fuel to the fire, or are we pursuing reconciliation? Are we pursuing justice for those who are still suffering because of generations of racial inequities? I saw this firsthand as a foster parent over the years of how this still continues to play out generation after generation. Are we a church that is obsessed with what team we are on, or are we so busy at the work of standing on our convictions and seeing the kingdom of God come on earth as it is in heaven that we don't even have time for the political fighting and pettiness of our day? Guys, I believe as a church that we can become more like Jesus in this area. Not because I'm mad at anybody, not because I'm coming down on anybody, but because I believe that we have room to grow, that we are still people who are being formed, that as a citizen of the kingdom of heaven, that I'm not going to let my political divides, I'm not going to let my country divides keep me from loving my neighbor well. I'm just not going to do it. We love our competing allegiances. But we don't owe Caesar everything. We don't owe our competing allegiances everything. What Jesus invites us to do is to release those and to say, my ultimate and only allegiance is to him. And as a result, Jesus gets all of me. We don't share leadership with Jesus in our lives. If your allegiance is God and blank, that's a competing allegiance. We don't share allegiance between God and party or God and money or even God and country. It is God alone. Jesus taught, hate father and mother as a hyperbole in comparison to your love for me, that everything else falls away and our sole and only allegiance is to him. Not giving up our convictions. Hear me on that. I'm not asking you to give up convictions because those are important things. But what I'm asking you to do is to allow those convictions to continue to be formed by your growth in Jesus, what he teaches, and who he is. And so as Jesus is having this conversation with these people in Mark 12, where they are trying to trap him and ultimately be able to put him to death, what they don't realize is that Jesus came willingly to give up power, to lay his life down for the sake of them and for the sake of the world. And so this question about paying this tax and who's got your ultimate allegiance eventually leads us somewhere else just a few verses later, where Jesus is asked the most important question. The question that is the supreme top question for any Jewish rabbi to ever have to answer. And the question is, Rabbi, what is the most important commandment? Like, what is, if you were to summarize the law, the way of living, the way of being in one kind of phrase, one kind of commandment, what would you say that is? What would you say captures the heart of God the absolute best? And you want to know what Jesus says? He says this in Mark chapter 12, verse 29. I'm going to read it from the Passion Translation. It's beautiful. He says, the most important of all the commandments is this. The Lord Yahweh, our God, is one. He's basically saying there is no other. There is no equal. There is no close second place. God is one. You are to love the Lord Yahweh, your God, with every passion of your heart, with all the energy of your being, with every thought that is within you, and with all your strength. This is the great and supreme commandment. In other words, one exclusive allegiance to God and to God alone. with everything you are, loving the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And then he says this, and the second is this, you must love your neighbor in the same way you love yourself. You will never find a greater commandment than these. Jesus invites us into a lifestyle of exclusive allegiance to him. And so as we close today, I want to ask you just a really kind of pointed, direct question for your life. I'm asking this for my life too. And the question is, what allegiances do I need to release? Do I need to let go of because of my exclusive allegiance to Jesus? Are there competing allegiances in my life? Are there idols in my life? Is politics an idol in my life? Is partisanship an idol in my life that I need to hold a little bit more loosely, that I need to release and let go of because I have an ultimate allegiance to Jesus? Is money and security and safety an ultimate or competing allegiance in my life that I need to release because of my exclusive allegiance to Jesus? Is it my family? Do I worry about my family all the time? Am I obsessed over worrying about my kids and trying to control them, manipulate them? And do I need to simply offer them to Jesus and say, Jesus, they are yours? I don't have a competing allegiance. I don't need to control. I don't need power. I need release and to submit them to your control and your authority. I don't know what it is for you, but I believe we live once again in a world that is demanding our allegiances. And if you are a disciple of Jesus, you don't get to share leadership with him in your life. We've surrendered that. And as a result, he comes in and he transforms and he changes things for us. Every other allegiance, every single one will let you down. Every single one will fail you. Your political allegiances, your financial allegiances, your relational allegiances. Jesus, as Lord of your life, is the one allegiance who will not let you down. Why? Because he already has laid his life down for you. He's already offered up himself. He's already set aside power and control and competing allegiances because he sought you. And so as we close today, we're gonna wrap up with a song. And I don't know if we've sung this at New Life before. I don't think we have. But it's a song called King of Kings. And it's this beautiful testament, this beautiful testimony of our exclusive allegiance to Jesus. And I don't know if you're listening to this in your car. I don't know if you're listening to this in your living room, but I would just encourage you to lean into this song, to worship together in this song, declaring with our hearts, with our minds, with our souls, with our strength that the Lord our God, the Lord is one. He is our ultimate and only allegiance, and every other allegiance falls away in light of who he is and what he has done for you. And so let me pray for you. I love you guys. I'm so excited to join together again in person and give great big hugs all around. But for now, let me pray for you and let's worship together. God, thank you so much for this community of people, this community that seeks to be generous with what they have, this community that seeks to continue to grow in our likeness of who you are, of what you've done for us. God, we love you so much. And today we declare that you are God, that there is no other, and that every other thing in our life that wants to demand our allegiance, that wants to take hold of our hearts and our minds and our affections and our attention, God, that we submit that to you. We invite you into those places to take control and to take ultimate authority and kingship in our lives. God, may we be the type of people that reflect your heart of humility and surrender. And as a result, may we love our neighbor and change our world. God, we love you. It's in your name and your name alone that we pray.